Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. These are the stories coming up on today's program. Papal Tribute. Pope Benedict praises the life and work of the late Cardinal Alfonso Trujillo, President of the Pontifical Council for the Family, in a homily at his Requiem Mass. US trip feedback. We speak to the rector of St. Joseph's Seminary in New York about his impressions of Pope Benedict's pastoral visit there last week. Sydney beckons. Pope Benedict's next overseas trip this year is to attend the World Youth Day celebrations in Australia in mid-July. And Cardinal Pell, the Archbishop of Sydney, looks ahead to this event. And Cherish Life. We talk to the founder of the Cherish Life Circle in New York City that helps both the families of murder victims and the criminal. Pope Benedict has paid tribute to Cardinal Alfonso Trujillo, President of the Pontifical Council for the Family, who died last weekend, in a homily at his Requiem Mass. Lydia Kane reports.
In the surroundings of St. Peter's Basilica, which would have been very familiar to Cardinal Trujillo during his life, the Dean of the College of Cardinals, Cardinal Angelo Sodano, on Wednesday presided over his funeral mass. The homily was given by Pope Benedict, who on Monday returned from a visit to the United States. The Holy Father said that when he received the news there, he immediately offered up a prayer to God for Cardinal Trujillo's soul.
Negli Stati Uniti, dove mi trovavo in visita pastorale, ho subito elevato a Dio una preghiera di suffragio per la sua anima.
The Pope said the late Cardinal had served the Church with generosity, and the Holy Father gave thanks to God for his many gifts.
L'Arcivescovo Alfonso López Trujillo risulto essere il
Pope Benedict then spoke about Cardinal Trujillo's life and long ministry in the Church, which began with studies in both Colombia and Rome, where he earned a doctorate in philosophy at the Pontifical University of St. Thomas Aquinas. He was ordained in 1960, and in 1971 he was made Auxiliary Bishop of Bogotá. Up until 1990, he was General Secretary of the Latin American Episcopal Conference. López Trujillo was named Cardinal by Pope John Paul II in the consistory of the 2nd of February 1983, becoming the youngest cardinal until 1991, something Pope Benedict made particular reference to. In 1990, López Trujillo was named President of the Pontifical Council for the Family. The cardinal held the position of President of the Council up until his death. Towards the end of his homily, the Pope said that in his role as President, the cardinal was committed to defending family values. Following the rites of committal presided over by Pope Benedict, Cardinal Trujillo's remains were transferred to the Vatican Parish Church of Santa Ana for burial. I'm Lydia O'Kane.
Pope Benedict returned to the Vatican on Monday at the conclusion of his six-day pastoral visit to the US, a visit which dominated the American media and attracted huge crowds. His stay in Washington, D.C. and New York coincided with the third anniversary of his election to the papacy and also his 81st birthday. The Pope's packed agenda included an address to the UN General Assembly, the celebration of two outdoor masses, talks with President Bush at the White House, and a visit to Ground Zero, the site of the 9/11 terrorist attacks. But now that this much-anticipated visit is over, what impressions has Pope Benedict left behind? What feedback is there from the faithful and Americans in general? Well, to find out more, I spoke to Bishop Gerald Walsh, the rector of St. Joseph's Seminary in Yonkers, New York. The seminary was one of the venues visited by the Pope during his trip, and where he had two engagements. The first, a meeting with a group of disabled children, and the second, a rally with young people and seminarians. Bishop Walsh told me that the Pope's US trip is being seen as an unqualified success.
The journey went very, very well. People were very enthusiastic when they heard and saw the Holy Father. For me, I was at the seminary where he came to have a rally with young people, but before that he spent a half an hour in the seminary chapel with 55 disabled children, their parents, and their caretakers. And it was there that we saw how human he was, how caring and affectionate he was to the children. He blessed each child, some he blessed twice as he came in and as he left. He made a wonderful impression with the people, and I'm sure that impression was carried over through the television programs and the radio people who were listening to him and filming him. So it was a wonderful, wonderful experience to see how human and how caring the Pope is.
And what kind of feedback have you got from people there, not just, say, in the seminary, but, you know, just people in general in New York City? Because he was a bit of an unknown quantity before. You know, they knew the previous Pope. He'd been there several times. But this Pope, of course, was somebody new for them.
Pope Benedict's background, of course, before he became Pope, was as an official in the Vatican, and therefore his work was, in one sense, behind the scenes. Now that he has been here and people have seen him in a parish, St. Joseph's on the east side, at Ground Zero, at the cathedral, at Yankee Stadium, and here at the seminary, they now see the complete person, and they realize this is a real pastor, a pastoral man, who's preaching the gospel message in a very positive manner, not looking at people's mistakes or people's erroneous interpretations, but rather focusing on the positive, focusing on the need to be a people of hope and trust, and above all, to be a people of peace. Peace first with God, peace with other people, and at peace with themselves. And if they do any or all of that, the society we live in will be a much better place. So he came across very, very well. I've heard really no complaint. I've heard nothing but positive reaction from the young and the old. He made a wonderful impression on many of the young high school and college students who were here at the seminary for the youth rally.
He also pulled no punches when he talked, for instance, about his sorrow over the clerical sexual abuse scandal. He was amazingly frank, and he returned to this subject again and again. Did that surprise people in a way?
I don't think so. The Pope did not duck any issue. To quote the mayor of New York City, who's not a Catholic, Mayor Bloomberg, praising him on the radio last night, I heard a section. He was impressed very, very much with the fact that the Pope did not hide. He apologized for the abuse scandal and said, "We are doing everything we possibly can to make sure it never happens again." And it was a sign that this is a Pope who does not fear to deal with issues that are not always too pleasant, but they are issues that must be dealt with. So, people were very, very favorably impressed by his willingness to talk about good things and things that are not so good.
Now, you talked there about individual reactions and feedback, but what about the coverage in the press as a whole? Was it very much blanket-to-blanket coverage? What kind of things were they saying? Is anything that sticks out in your mind?
It was blanket-to-blanket from the moment he got off the plane in Washington to the moment he got on the plane back in Kennedy Airport. I haven't read most of it yet because we've been involved going every place where the Pope was, but what I have seen is very positive. Very grateful that he came to these two central cities in the United States, especially to the city of New York, where the big anniversary is of the Archdiocese, 200 years old. He went to the UN, and I think that was one of the main reasons for the pastoral visit, to impress upon the United Nations the ability they have. If they work together, if they work openly and honestly, they have a wonderful opportunity to create peace in all parts of the world. So as of today, I have yet to see anything negative in the press. Most of it has been very, very positive, and we're looking forward to that continuing and having an effect as we go now in the times ahead.
Well, you talked there about having an effect. His message, of course, was Christ is our hope. Do you think this message will be absorbed by the people in the U.S., and do you think it really will help to strengthen the church, strengthen people in their faith?
Hopefully it will. It will take time because the people that he was speaking with are young people. Many are in high school, many are in college, and they are all working very, very hard to listen to what the Pope had to say and hopefully to put it into the way they live their lives. Very interesting thing happened during the youth rally when they began, as young people do, they began a chant. The chant was, "Benedict is our Pope, Christ is our hope." So if they can blend those two together, then the answer to your question is that in the long run, it will be a very, very productive pastoral visit.
That was Bishop Walsh of St. Joseph's Seminary in New York.
Every nation, every tribe, come together.
Pope Benedict's next overseas pastoral visit this year takes him to another Anglophone country, Australia, where he will attend the World Youth Day celebrations in the city of Sydney in mid-July. Cardinal George Pell, Archbishop of Sydney, spoke to my colleague Charles Collins about preparations and expectations for the World Youth Day event.
Basically, they're going quite well. We have no major hitches, no unexpected challenges, so it's unrolling pretty much according to schedule.
How many people do you expect? There had been some concern because of the distance to Australia from many of the other parts of the world.
Well, everybody's always known about the distance, that it was going to be a problem. There are some new difficulties. The weakening of the American dollar puts a little bit of extra pressure on the 38,500 who have said they are likely to come from the United States of America. In some places, it's a little bit difficult to get flights. People might have to go indirectly, say, come to Australia from the States via the Philippines or Japan, and then south. But our numbers are holding up. We look like having about 160,000 from overseas, so some names are being added, some names are coming off. So the numbers are holding up well, and they're above expectations, above our estimate.
And what about, you mentioned the Philippines, what about Asia? Do you see a large amount coming from there?
There'll be a significant number from Asia, although they're much closer than many other parts of the world. The great problem there is a lack of money. They don't have the wherewithal. But we've made a special effort to help pilgrims from Papua New Guinea and the Pacific Islands. For example, they only pay a $50 registration fee, and we've made many, many parishes and dioceses are working to help subsidise their fares. So the numbers from New Zealand, Papua New Guinea and the islands are two or three times what we had initially estimated.
What is the awareness of this event outside of the Catholic community in Australia?
It's growing steadily, especially around Sydney. And we're now starting to get quite a lot of publicity. In the last day or so, I think the state government in Sydney has announced the road closures for the World Youth Day, and obviously that has provoked a bit of consternation. So in all sorts of ways, people are becoming aware that there are likely to be more visitors from overseas to Sydney for the World Youth Day than there were for the Olympics, which were a huge success.
An aspect of World Youth Day does have a missionary emphasis, both to the Catholic youth themselves, but also many of the events that happen during the World Youth Day are public. One thinks of the Stations of the Cross,
mm-hmm.
that have become a tradition for World Youth Day. How much importance is given to missionary activity in Australia?
Well, there are many types of missionary activity. There's evangelization. I suppose there'd be quite some scope in Australia for what you might call re-evangelization. So there are very considerable opportunities. And we have not a big number, but a steady stream of adults who come into the church. Either they were without baptism or they come into full communion, they were members of other Christian denominations. So we're increasingly sensitive to that. In the seminary in which I'm in charge of, each of the seminarians has to do a couple of missions out in the parishes, out in the shopping centres, out in the streets. And we're hoping in the young priests to be that we will develop an even deeper sensibility to the need to evangelise, to go out and talk about Christ and offer Christ to other people.
How difficult is that in Australian society, which has become highly secular? There is some social fragmentation, as of all Western civilization seems to have gone nowadays. How difficult is this re-evangelization?
Well, there are significant differences across the Western world. Sociologically, we're somewhere between the religious situation of the United States and the religious situation in Britain. I think secularism hasn't run as far or as deeply in Australia as it has in the United Kingdom. There's much less hostility to religion in Australia than there is in the United States, but there's also considerably less religious enthusiasm. So our problem is indifference, and it's hard work to interest people. People aren't, especially the young, generally are not hostile at all, and quite a few of them are interested to hear what we have to say. But to convert interest into commitment, that's the challenge. But the World Youth Day will help that greatly, and also the Pope is a great teacher, so he'll certainly have something to say.
That was Cardinal George Pell of Sydney talking to my colleague Charles Collins. Helping the families of murder victims and also the criminal who's facing the death penalty. Those are the twin activities of the Cherished Life Circle, a group in the US founded by the Sisters of Mercy to advocate for the abolition of capital punishment. The circle's primary goal is to campaign for the abolition of the death penalty through civil discourse and programs that uphold the sacredness of all life. One of its key activities is the annual holding of an ecumenical candlelight prayer service for the families of murder victims. Other activities include corresponding with people awaiting execution on death row, and also sometimes acting as a spiritual advisor to one or more of those prisoners. The Cherished Life Circle believes that no matter how horrendous the crime convicted, the perpetrator is a human being capable of repentance and turning over a new leaf. The circle was founded in 1993 by Camille D'Arienzo, a Sister of Mercy based in New York City, together with other religious sisters from the order. She told me more about their aims and activities.
I formed the Cherished Life Circle in 1993 when Governor Mario Cuomo, who was in ardent advocate of the abolition of the death penalty, was going out of office, and the then Governor Pataki was coming into office hoping to restore the death penalty to New York State. We did not have it at that time in our state. I had in my circle of friends, religious, lay, and priests, people who have come together to discuss the significant issues of our times, war and peace, poverty. And when we looked at this, we said, what are we going to do to enter this dialogue and to try to prevent what the incoming governor hopes to bring? So we came together, as we do, educated people who pray, who speak, who write, who have educational platforms, and we began to promote that. Now, one of the things that we did at that time was we circulated a document which has been signed by people in Rome as well as other parts of the world. It is called a Declaration of Life, and that document says in its essence that I, the signer, whoever that signer is so opposed to the death penalty that were I to be murdered, I would not want my killer executed. That gives people an opportunity to speak very strongly for themselves without condemning people who entertain different views.
Now, I know that one of the things you do is organize an annual candlelit ecumenical service for people who have suffered the loss of their loved ones through murder. Can you tell us very briefly something about that?
Yes, I will tell you first, though, as a founder of the Cherished Life Circle, through circumstances not of my choosing, but now of my great appreciation, I am a spiritual advisor to a man on death row in Terre Haute, Indiana, David Paul Hammer. So I know very well the suffering of those who are awaiting execution. Some years ago, I would say 10 years ago now, we began to reach out to those relatives and friends of people who had been murdered. So we work with another group called Safe Horizon, which helps people who have suffered abuse. And every year at our Convent of Mercy in Brooklyn, a beautiful chapel that's been there since 1894, we have a service which invites people who have so suffered, and about 100 people will come. We as a Cherish Life Circle spend some time during the social and refreshment hour before listening to them, comforting them, giving them a chance to speak of their own pain. And then we move into the chapel where we have a lovely service. It is not a Catholic service because most of the people who come to us in the New York area are people of color, many from the Protestant tradition. So it's an ecumenical service. It's candlelight. Names are called. People are remembered. And very often we have a speaker, briefly, who has suffered the murder of a loved one, too. It is a very wonderful thing that we do. And now other groups are beginning to copy this, and we're happy about that.
It must be a very emotional and moving thing. I mean, presumably a lot of people must choke up, you know, at this service. What's it like?
Yes, we had a woman come as an observer for the first time. Now, she didn't have anyone die in her own family, but she was looking to plan a similar service in her parish. And I watched this woman, Dr. Clara Garrett, sitting there listening to the stories of these heartbroken people, and tears just wet her face. So yes, now, and I won't say that we're hardened to it, but we are used to this. We've seen it now 10 times, and it is comforting. One of the surprising things about these services, while we have had these 10 years, only once have we had anyone call for the death penalty for the person who murdered his son. Now, I think that's extraordinary. It is much more common for us to see these wounded, faith-filled people say, "I don't want another mother to suffer the pain I have endured." So they want punishment, but not execution.
Now, you mentioned earlier that you are spiritual advisor to a man on death row called David Hammer. Can you briefly sketch for us the reason that he ended up on death row and how long he's been there?
David Paul Hammer is 49 years old, and he has been continually incarcerated since he was 19. He grew up in poverty in the state of Oklahoma with parents who were migrant workers and a mother who was abusive. They moved around a great deal so that his education was never complete. It was a different school every few months. By the time he was 16 and the victim of psychological, physical, sexual abuse, he ran away, got into drugs, married at 16, fathered a child, and at 19 was involved in armed robbery. He had been before the judge a number of times, and in, I guess, exasperation, the judge then sentenced him to 1,200 years, no possibility of parole. Now, at 19, when he heard the doors slam behind him, he had no reason to accommodate the system, whereas no social system had served him well. So he continued to do, you know, negative things in prison, and in 1996, he murdered a cellmate, for which he got the death penalty. But in the meantime, he underwent a conversion and has become, well, they call him at Terre Haute the unofficial chaplain. He is so good with the other inmates. He's brilliant, and he's a paralegal. He takes care of their appeals. He looks out for their special needs. No one on death row has money, and most of them are there because of poor counsel. He helps them in 100 ways. He also designs Christmas cards, which we sell every year. And for the past 7 years, we have probably contributed over $50,000 or $60,000 to help children in need, mostly in agencies responsibly handled by religious institutions. David was confirmed a Catholic, brought into the faith in his cell in Terre Haute, Indiana, in October of 2000. He has passed 3 execution dates, and most recently his death sentence has been vacated because of information that went to the nature of the killing. It was not premeditated, it was accidental. But he remains on death row because the government is appealing that.
Now, you said he had a very abusive childhood, particularly his mother. There was one incident there that you told me about earlier that involved a puppy, right?
Mm-hmm. When David was about 10 years old, he had a younger brother, slightly retarded, and a still younger sister, probably about 6 years old. Someone took compassion on these really poor children, hungry, very often hungry children, not cared for, and clearly being abused. And they gave the family a puppy. Now, anyone who has ever owned a dog knows how quickly the bonding occurs. And so it was that in the course of the day, the three children played with the dog, they owned it, they loved it, and when the mother came home, she went into one of her irrational fits. She sent David up to the house, the shack, to get a burlap bag, and she sent the two younger children away. Then she forced David to watch her while she clubbed the puppy to death. He screamed in protest, screamed and cried, and to no avail. And when the puppy was dead, she forced David to drag the burlap bag to the nearby pond and throw it in. It was kind of interesting that the last day that David was supposed to be executed, his execution date was set. It was about 48 hours before the execution. He was told that the execution wouldn't take place. I was with him the day the execution was to take place. That was June 8th, 2004. We were together in a prison cell. And at the end of the time, we prayed together. But that night he called a friend in Indianapolis, and he said, I want you to do me a favor. I want you to go to the dog pound, and I want you to rescue a dog that is slated to be executed, slated for death, an unwanted animal. He said, I can't save another human being, but perhaps I can save a dog. And so the woman he called went, and she got the dog, and David calls that his dog, which was trained to visit elderly people in the nursing homes. And so that dog lives because David lives. But I'm sure there's a connection with that childhood memory.
Okay, coming back to the families of murder victims, have you got any feedback from those who you have helped or any other poignant anecdotes to share with us?
Oh, there are so many. There is one woman whose son was murdered 14 years ago. Her name is Vida Ibrahim, and she has come to every service. She loves them. She says it's the only place where she really feels that people understand and she's at home. One of the first services, it might have been the very first one we had, we pre-register everybody. We make out signs that bear the names of the murdered person, and the family member representing the murdered person wears that sign in the chapel during the service. Well, just as the service was about to begin, I could hear someone running up the steps. And there was a young boy, all dressed in suit and tie and brown shoes. It's a small African-American child. And I said, honey, what are you doing here? And he said, my mama sent me. I said, but do you know what this is? And he said, yes, my mama only heard today that it's for people who were murdered. My brother was murdered. How old was he? He was 15. My mom is sick, she couldn't come, so she sent me. How did you get here? I took two trains. The boy was 10 years old. So, you know, we quickly made a sign and added his brother's name to the list, and we seated him with some of the mothers in the chapel. And when his brother's name was called and he stood to go to the center aisle, to go into the sanctuary with his lighted candle, which was part of the ritual, he burst out crying. His little shoulders shook, and mothers surrounded him and brought him up, you know, to the sanctuary. And it was a very moving moment. And then when the service was over, I looked for that child. I needed more information about him, but he was gone. He wasn't where the refreshments were. He wasn't out on the street. But that boy in the brown shoes remains in my mind almost 10 years now as kind of the angel that alerts us to the fact that children should not see that violence has the last word, and that faith can help individuals to overcome the worst hardships, and that there is a community of support.
So you never found out where he came from or anything more?
No,
about him?
Nothing.
I was speaking there to Camille D'Arienzo, a Sister of Mercy from New York City.
Well, that's all for today, but we'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow. And you can always find our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.